Well, we're looking at Revelation chapter 7 in our studies, Revelation chapter 7. Let's begin by reading the verses we're going to be dealing with today. And after these things, I saw four angels standing on the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth, nor on the sea, nor on any tree. Let's stop right there and try to understand some things from what we begin to see here in this verse. And one thing you begin to see right off is something that should help us to understand a lot of the politics that's going on today and the way of climate control. Man thinks that somehow or other he's going to be able to do something to save the earth. The truth is, and we understand this point, and I believe in this church because of the teaching we've received over the years concerning these matters. Climate control, the way it's being used in political circles today, is in reality nothing in the world but human control. That's all it amounts to, is human control. It's not the climate that is in view. It's trying to manipulate people's thinking in such a way as to make them believe that somehow or other what they're doing is contributing to the problems we're having in nature. If people just knew the truth on that one point about what the government does in the way of polluting this world, and particularly this nation, we would be amazed that the subject would even be brought up. I received something the other week in the way of an email emphasizing that there are 535 people responsible for everything that's happening in this country. We've had in North Carolina all kinds of pollution problems. And just about every one of these pollution problems could have been squared away if government was doing its job the way it's supposed to, the dumping of waste materials into our rivers and things like that. Why is that happening? Well, it's because a lot of big companies are giving big time bucks to politicians to leave them alone so that people that are more concerned about a dollar bill than they are being keepers of what God has given us. We know what our responsibility is as Christians as we study the Bible. We are supposed to keep our rivers clean. We're not supposed to throw trash out the window of our car. We know that. We know how to take care of our own homes. We're supposed to. We have trash cans, and when things die, we go out and bury it. We know something about cleanliness. That's why we wash our dishes and do all the things that we can to stay healthy. We know what our responsibility is. The Bible even says, a righteous man regardeth the life of his beasts. We shouldn't have people... What do you call it when they raise these puppies in these puppy mills? That's what they call it, where animals are abused, and every once in a while on the networks you'll see, you know, pleas for money to be given because of all the suffering animals. And so you see these rescue missions going up all over the country just trying to rescue animals. Well, what we need to do is just get back to the Bible, read the Bible, and believe the Bible, and understand that climate is technically not in the control of man if he just does what he's supposed to do. He can keep his own backyard clean and his rivers clean and so forth. But what's going on in the world today is big time business. Paying off politicians to not implement reasonable controls over the evil nature of man that doesn't love God but loves mammon more than God and more than his neighbor and anyone else. But the Bible tells us that the seasons and planting and all of the things that God intended from the beginning is going to continue to happen until the end. The end of all things. Seasons are going to be with us. And God is ultimately in control of the environment. And that's what we learn in the very first verse. Let's read it. And after these things, I saw four angels standing on the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth, nor on the sea, nor on any tree. And then in verse 2, it connects with it. And I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God. And he cried with a loud voice to the four angels, to whom it was given to hurt the earth and the sea, saying, hurt not the earth, neither the sea nor the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God in their foreheads. And so the Bible tells us here that man is not ultimately the one that's going to hurt the earth. It's going to be God himself. Because it's his, and he can do with it what he pleases at any time. I used to marvel at, the politicians who would not let the the lumberjacks and the big lumber mills to go into certain parts of the mountain country in the west and harvest the trees. And sometimes it was because you did get people that got out of control and did clear cutting because erosion and things of that sort. But that was not always the case. And so anyway, government gets in there on the basis of the encouragement of the climate control people, and they pass laws that you can't go up there and harvest these trees. And then all of a sudden, Mount St. Helens blew its top. And how many millions upon millions of trees were within minutes destroyed? And we saw images coming over the networks showing rivers completely clogged up with trees floating down the rivers. And so the Lord did some clear cutting of his own. And not only that, a lot of animals died. A lot of animals died. And when you begin to talk about these kinds of things, people can get an attitude toward God. And so, okay, that's somewhat of a contradiction. Doesn't God love the animals? And why did he kill the animals? A lot of those innocent animals Why did he kill the trees? All those things. Why would he seal 12,000 out of each of the 12 tribes of Israel, and yet many of the Jews would still nevertheless die? Why would God do that? Folks, a lot of times you can read the Bible and just not get it, what the Lord is saying. You see, from our perspective, the animals are precious, and we can't understand why the Lord would allow terrible things to happen to the animals. The trees are precious. Why would he let things happen to the trees? Why would he seal 12,000 and not seal all of the Jews? Why wouldn't he seal all Christians and protect us in such a way that bad stuff never happened to a believer? Bad stuff is happening to believers all over this world right now today. Bad things. I got an email the other day where a Christian in a Muslim country gotten saved, and when it was discovered, they apprehended the man and began to torture him. And they took him and tied him by his feet upside down and dipped his head in cold water and then hot water back and forth. They beat him to a pulp. Somehow or other, this man survived the ordeal and was enabled to later escape to tell the story of what was happening to Christians over there. It makes you wonder, why does the Lord allow things like that to happen? And it especially occurs to you when you're reading Revelation chapter 7, why would the Lord seal 12,000 out of the 12 tribes? And yet, in this same chapter, we find that there are so many people that are going to be slain that they cannot be numbered among Jews and Gentiles. And so how do we understand these things? Well, I think it's much like the way we understand the rapture of the church and the thinking of many that the reason for the rapture of the church is because we're so special, we're going to be delivered from the terrible things that are going to happen in this world. That's a completely wrong understanding of the Bible and God and his purposes and the message of this book. The reason one generation is going to escape the tribulation period has nothing to do with the fact that we are special above others, that we're somehow or other more special than those that suffered the tremendous persecution they did and wrath in ages past, especially those in the first century when Titus and the Romans invaded and slaughtered several million Jews and leveled the city, destroyed the temple. And so how do you understand then the purpose of the rapture of the church? Well, I can tell you the answer. It's in the Bible. That's how I know the answer. The answer has to do not with man and what he would like for himself, which is deliverance from everything that's bad. It has to do with God and his program and his purposes and his design. That's what it has to do with. And so we oftentimes regard our lives as ever so precious. But I'll tell you what's precious. It's the life of the Lord Jesus Christ. It's the life of the Lord Jesus Christ. That's the thing that's precious in this book. And the truth is, we're all going to die. All of us are. We're going to die. We don't know when. We do not know how. But what is life really all about? It's about the Lord. It's about His will and purpose. It's about His designs and about how He is a good God and a loving God. And He loves us more than we could ever know. But our perspective is somewhat humanistic. We look at everything in terms of ourselves and not in terms of God. Yeah. Oh, I believe so, yeah. Absolutely.
It's hard for us to wrap the mind around that.
Mm-hmm.
But 144,000 committed Jews, I mean, that Jesus Christ is, who He said He is,
mm-hmm.
radical impact on the Jewish community.
Mm-hmm.
And these are from the Jewish community. These aren't people from all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. Well, see, there's just so many factors that come together to make this such an amazing time period in human history. It's marked in many ways that give it distinctiveness as compared to any other period in human history. For instance, more people are going to die in a short period of time, beginning at the tribulation period, than has ever died at any given time in human history. More people are going to get saved at that particular time than have ever been saved in human history. More than can be numbered are going to get saved. Another thing that is conspicuous about this time period that we're beginning to study here in Revelation, the Lord is going to intervene. He's going to intervene in ways that we have never experienced, especially this generation. And one of the things that's going to primarily result in people getting saved is not the witness of the 144,000. They're going to be part of it. That's not going to be the major thing. If you read carefully Ezekiel 37 and 38 and 39, you'll there discover what causes the national conversion of Israel, what causes them to turn to God. And as a matter of fact, the whole world, because what we learn in this seventh chapter as we get into it, especially verse 9. Let's read verse 9. After this I beheld, and lo, a great multitude which no man could number, of all nations and kindreds and people and tongues, stood before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes and palms in their hands. Then as we read on down in the 14th verse, and I said unto him, Sir, thou knowest, and he said to me, these are they which came out of great tribulation and have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. And so in the tribulation period, if you compare what is said right here with Ezekiel 38 and 39, you'll understand why we have the greatest revival in the history of the world. It's because no person on the face of the earth will at that time not know that He is the Lord. It will be known that He is the Lord. And it will not be because of man and what he does. It'll be because of God and what He does. And so the Lord is manifesting His providential control of all things, especially as we get into this chapter. And we see it here when it comes to weather. God is in total control of the weather. Salvation is of the Lord, period. It's not of man, it's not of preachers, it's not of missionaries, it's not of the tract society. Salvation is of the Lord. If anybody gets saved ever, and it appears that man is somehow or other partly responsible, it's only because God is so good to us to invite us into his program. He invites us to put our neck in the yoke and learn of him and what he is able to do with human beings that deserve to be thrown into hell forever and forgotten forever. But because of his mercy and his grace and his great love for us, he died in our place to give us eternal life as a free gift. And people are going to begin to believe this gospel. But what Jim is talking about there is exactly right, because God is going to use people that will be given the gift of understanding to be able to go out there and explain what the scriptures teach. Kind of like, you know, the Ethiopian eunuch. He didn't understand what he was reading. And when Philip joined the buggy there and got close to him and asked him what he was reading, he said, Isaiah. But he didn't understand what it was all about. Well, it was Isaiah 53. And so Philip said, he climbed up in the buggy with him and opened the scriptures and taught him what it meant, that it was an Old Testament prophecy of Christ, his crucifixion, his death, and burial and resurrection, and how that we could be saved if we put our faith and trust in him, who is the giver of life. And so the eunuch got saved. And so this is what the 144,000 are going to be doing, along with the angel that's going to be preaching the everlasting gospel, as we'll see later as well. So, yeah. Absolutely. That's right. Well, the Lord is going to supernaturally intervene to save Israel. Listen, that's such a little place over there. I mean, Israel is tiny. You know.
Quite narrow.
Yeah. And so the Six-Day War, for instance, would be a good thing to remember. There's no way in the world, logically, you can explain the Six-Day War apart from God. There's no way you can logically explain 1948 and how Israel could be restored as a nation. And they still even know who they are as a people. I mean, if I were to ask you right now, is your pedigree, are you Irish? Are your ancestors from Scotland? What part of the world did you come from? What most people wouldn't know. I have no clue, really. I've heard my parents talk about it. We've got some in our family that have studied genealogies. I could care less about genealogies. I just know I'm a Gentile. That's all I need to know. I needed to get saved, and I did. But what we're fixing to see here is something that's absolutely amazing to me. And that is that God is the only one in the universe that not only knows the future before it happens, he's the only one that truly knows the past. And we're fixing to see that. But before we get to that, let's consider a couple other things here. The second point I wanted to make out of the seventh chapter is is how government and religion are inseparably related. The Lord is getting ready to save a nation. He's getting ready to unite the nation. You remember, Israel was not always united. It was divided after Solomon's death. And 10 tribes went to the north. And then there was Benjamin and Judah to the south. And it remained divided until the Assyrians took away the northern 10 tribes and the Babylonians took away the southern 2 tribes. Then they were scattered throughout the world by future conquerors, such as the Persians, and then the Greeks, and then the Romans. And then when the Romans got done with them in 70 A.D., they were scattered throughout every nation in the world. And so the amazing thing about 1948 is that God started calling these people out of these countries to go back to their homeland. And it's a mystery how they even knew that they were a Jew. And it's more of a mystery that any of them could know what tribe they came from. How would they know? I'm telling you, you go up to Gentiles and they can't tell you anything like that. We just do not know. We're so disconnected with the past and things have been so mixed up and there's been intermarriage with all kinds of people in the world. But the Lord still classifies the whole world as being either Jew or Gentile. Anybody that's not a Jew is a Gentile. And that's the classification. And the reason is because there's only 2 kinds of people in the mind of God, and that's saved and lost. You're either saved or you're lost. And the Jew, and the only thing that's special about them, the only thing that's special about them, because they're no different than a Gentile. Hell is going to be full of Jews, folks. Hell is going to be full of Gentiles. But when God made Adam and Eve, he didn't make, you know, Adam a Jew and Eve a Gentile. They were Jews. I mean, or they were the people of God, not Jews. They were the people of God. But at a later time, when Abraham comes along, the Lord is going to showcase what it means to be a child of God. And that's all in the world Abraham is about. Essentially, he was just the offspring of Adam, neither Jew nor Gentile. Why? Because ultimately, God loved the whole world. For God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life. And so why then did the Jews become distinguished from the rest of the people in the world? Listen, it's not because they're super special. It's not. They're only super special in the sense that they would showcase what it meant to trust God and him alone as your hope for eternal life. That's all in the world they amounted to. So when you get to Ephesians chapter 2, for instance, the Apostle Paul begins to reveal a mystery that was hidden in ages past. And that's how there's no real difference in the mind of God between a Jew and a Gentile. And how through the blood of the cross, he made both one. And so the Lord talks about, you know, being a Jew spiritually or being one physically through circumcision. And Paul made it very clear that circumcision didn't make you a Jew, not a child of God. It would just serve as a sign. It would be an outward sign. And circumcision was just basically a picture, as a type of the death of the flesh. When it comes to the origin of life, when it comes to the male makeup and so forth and reproduction, the reason the foreskin was cut off is because it had to do with the future and birth and all of these kinds of things. And how that when it came to man, the only hope that he had for birth was death to the flesh And that's what circumcision is all about. So when you study the scriptures carefully, you begin to understand that God is not really making a person special that's circumcised. He's not making a person special that's a Jew as compared to a Gentile. Not at all. When he died on that cross, he died for Jew and Gentile. Luke wrote Luke's gospel and the whole book of Acts. He was a Gentile. He was a physician. He was a Gentile, but just as saved and beloved, God used him to teach future generations that the Christian faith is based upon evidence that cannot be refuted. And that was the main purpose of Luke's writing, is the relationship between faith and evidence. It's interesting that the number 12 out of the 12 tribes is in the scriptures a symbol of human government. And the reason the Lord would choose 12,000 out of 12 tribes is because he was fixing to bring together what cannot be separated in order to have government or to have civilization or community life. And that is, the only way you can have unity and have civilization is for the law of God to be lived out in our daily life, keeping the Ten Commandments. That's how you have peace among men. This is how you have a good neighbor, is for your neighbor to love God just like you love God and keep his commandments the same way that you keep his commandments. That way you can leave your lawnmower out there in the yard and throw your keys away and they'll still be there tomorrow, because thou shalt not steal. That's how you have civilization. That's how you have government. All we have to do is believe God. And so there's symbolism all over the place here in what we're reading. And so we're fortunate in our church to have been taught Bible symbolism and the symbolism of numbers. Like number one, the number of singular importance. And number two, the number of witness. Like the witness of two is true. The number three, the number of completion. The number four, revelation. The number five, the number of grace. Six is the number of man. Seven is the number of perfection. Eight is a number of new beginnings. 11 is a number of disorder. And so it was an 11-day journey from Sinai to the land of Canaan. But they ended up wandering in the wilderness for 40 years. And it was only an 11-day journey. Why does the Lord tell us that? Because of the disorder that comes into your life when you do not obey God and follow the leadership that the Lord has provided. And God raised up Moses for a leader, and they didn't follow him, but they murmured and they complained. They were always thinking of something to complain about. And we need to learn from these things. So anyway, we need to pay attention again to the particulars as we get into the book of the Revelation, and realize that it's with significance that we read about 12,000 from each tribe and the 12 tribes. Why? Because God is fixing now to put Israel back together, not as a divided nation, which it was since the captivity of the Assyrians and the Babylonians. So for all of these years, 2,500 years, Israel has had no nation. and they were divided. And so God is now going to unite them in His truth. Let's look at some other things here. So, in verse 1, I just wanted to re-remind you of the fact that climate control is in reality human control. It has nothing to do with the climate. Any more than, you know, the scientists, they were studying the sun and the power and energy of the sun, and they learned a lot of things about the corona, the outward edge of the sun, and how the temperature that surrounds the sun is many, many, many times hotter than in the sun or in the core of the sun. Much hotter. I don't know why, but they've explained that. And so when you have these explosions, these, I guess, atomic-type explosions, a kind of nuclear fission of some sort where this heat just bounces up thousands of miles out into the surrounding, circle of the sun. I wouldn't say atmosphere. I don't know that it has atmosphere in the sense that we would use that word. But the idea is that there could be explosions up there that would impact the earth with harmful rays and so forth, and energy that would knock out all of our computer networks in the whole earth. And that we've experienced that in some measure in certain parts of our country already, where power grids went out and they were attributing it to something out there entering in through our atmosphere as a result of the sun's activity. Okay? Do you know anybody, maybe like an Al Gore, that could help us when it comes to the sun and those explosions up there? You reckon he could come forth in a meeting and give us some suggestions about what we could do? That's a joke. It's just a joke. If we just really could realize how powerful and how delicate this universe is, and life itself, how delicate life is. We're concerned about things way off out there. We've got things going on in our bodies that are so delicate. We have no idea what's happening inside of us at any time. That could be good or could be terrible. We never know. We're at best fragile. That's why the psalmist David said, "Lord, make me to know mine end and the measure of my days, what it is that I may know how frail I am." How frail I am. What about our souls? What about our souls, our eternal souls? Do we understand that we are a trinity made in the image of God, spirit, soul, and body? And that the body aspect is of minor importance to God as compared to our souls. Why did He die? Did He die to save our bodies? No. That's very superficial. Why did He die? Because the greater part of our being is spiritual. God is a spirit. Listen, where was God before the creation of the worlds? He was where He always was. The Spirit of God and the being of God and His eternal wisdom and knowledge and understanding and His eternal power was not handicapped because there was not a physical dimension. Not at all. And so The lesser always comes from the greater. And so the greater part of our being is like God, spiritual, not physical. And so if God for eternity past always has been, and then at some point in eternity he created the material universe that we now see and experience in our bodies, then how much smaller and insignificant is that as compared to God? And if we're created in his image, isn't it true with ourselves as well? So why did Christ die on the cross? Did he die to save our bodies? Well, if he did, he would have yanked that thief that was on the cross right beside of him off and said, "Look, I came to save you so that you'd never die." But he didn't do that. He said, "This day shalt thou be with me in paradise." Today. This day. Meaning that that person that that thief was not going to die and never would die. And he gave him at that moment eternal life, which is not just a state of being where you have life as though life is the important thing. Listen, life is a person. Heaven is not just a place. Heaven is where Christ is. If Christ is not there, heaven, it's not heaven. We are so saturated with humanism, we can't hardly think straight. Why would the Apostle Paul desire to depart and be with Christ, which would be far better? Was he messed up or are we messed up? Can we relate to things like that? Can we relate to him saying, "I count not my life dear unto myself," when his brethren were pleading for him not to go to Jerusalem? He looked forward to that time when he could go and be in the presence of the one he loved, Jesus Christ. And we would do well to think more and more that way every day. And pray every day that God would deliver us from our humanism. We have our own way of wanting to look at all of these things. And especially when it comes to the rapture of the church. Oh, maybe we'll escape all the problems that are going to come on the world. Well, I'm not saying that I wouldn't be glad, because I would. But why am I any better than Kent Kelly or Don Despain or R.J. Rushdoony or Henry Morris or C.H. Spurgeon or the Apostle Paul or the untold thousands that have been persecuted and tortured, who loved the Lord and were hated by the world? And so I have to be very careful, because I have this humanistic desire too, to want to live for, you know, the better life, the benefits of heaven and earth. But the reason the Lord is now getting ready to hurt the earth and hurt the trees and hurt the seas and kill a lot is because it has to do with his purposes. His purposes. And so 144,000 were going to be sealed in such a way that they could not die and would be able to go all the way through all the horrible things that were going to happen in the tribulation period, and it wouldn't touch them. But folks, if you're not careful, you'll miss the fact that this is not all the Jews. 144,000 is not all the Jews. And out of this number that cannot be numbered, untold thousands of Jews were going to die that were not supernaturally protected. So, does that mean that God loved the 144,000 more than he did the others that would die? Well, that's not understanding the Bible. We need to listen to Paris Reedhead's tape at least 100 times until it finally begins to sink in what humanism is. And the utilitarian message that's preached in most churches today, the humanism that has infiltrated the church, where everything is about the happiness of man and nothing about the happiness of God. Life is not about the happiness of man. It's about the happiness of God. It's about the glory of God. It's about him being good and how he was treated when he came down here into this world, and how we treat him every day. And how that in us is a nature that doesn't want to put aside that time every day to spend with him and him alone, to worship him and to love him for all that he is. And we're all the time watching our clocks, you know, to make sure that we give him just a little bit of time. But we want most of that time for ourselves. Do what we want to do. And our resources, our investments, is what we want out of life. It's not the purposes of God. Paris Reedhead said, in his explanation of the significance of the cross of Calvary and why it is that God brings us to the cross and the message of the cross, and it's over and over and over again. Why is it? It's because at the cross it's the only place that God can get glory out of a human being. It's the only place where he can show him what he deserves. He deserves to be thrown into hell forever and forgotten forever by God, to be lost without God in a universe that he has absolutely no control over. To be lost is to not have a reference point. It's to not know God. It's to only know yourself. And if we worship ourselves all our lives, we will be the only reference point we will have when we're in the woods. And you'll never get out of the woods if you don't have a reference point outside yourself. God is our only reference point. He's our only hope. And I think these thoughts emerge from these chapters we're reading here, because I'm telling you, it's hard to read the Bible and not see God through humanistic eyes as being a respecter of persons when he says he's not. Not a respecter of persons. But from our perspective, he's a respecter of persons. Otherwise, he wouldn't have sent, as it records in Ezekiel, I think it's the ninth chapter, first seven verses or so. He seals certain ones there, and the rest are to be destroyed, of men, women, and children. We read that. We think, is God really good? Why would he do that? Why would he send these people in there to slaughter men, women, and children? In our culture, you know, women, I mean, you treat them differently. And precious little children. But I'll tell you something, folks, precious little children are no different than venomous snakes when they're this long, that one day get this long. A snake is a snake. And a God-hating nature is a God-hating nature, and we're that way from the womb. God has his reasons for everything that he does. And we look at it and we say, this is not right. Really? I think we need to go back to the scriptures and see that God is righteous in everything that he does. And when we see what's going on in the tribulation period, where I'm telling you, untold numbers of people are going to die. A fourth and then a third of every human on the earth is going to die. If the rapture were to take place today, we're talking about things that would begin to happen within months from this time right now. So anyway, as we'll come back to this, Lord willing, next week, we'll try to look at the mark. What was it? What was the mark? They were marked. They were sealed on their foreheads. What was it? How does that tie in with the mark of Cain? What was the mark of Cain? Does anybody know what the mark of Cain was? We want to look at some of that and see what we can tell in the way of an answer after studying that subject. So next week we'll be looking at the mark. What is it? Let's pray. George, dismiss us, brother.
Help us to understand this thing. Be with the pastor who comes and open our hearts again.